The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Welcome to another weekend bonus episode of the Tech Meme Ride Home. I'm Brian McCullough. I've said it before, Stephen Levy is the Dean of Tech Writers. All the way back in 1984, his classic book, Hackers, defined a tech space that wasn't even fully aware of itself yet. Stephen has written book-length histories and examinations of Apple and Google, and now, with his new book, Facebook, The Inside Story, he finally tells the full Facebook story for the first time. Not the movie version, the real story of how Facebook became Facebook, from the earliest days at Harvard through the rise to 2.5 billion users. It is, as I tell him, the best tech book I've read in recent years. If you want to fully understand Facebook, or just how a modern startup works, or how a modern tech behemoth functions and thinks of itself in the world, I cannot recommend this book more highly. Link to buy the book in the show notes. So I know that this is sort of writer inside baseball a bit to start out this way, but you got a lot of cooperation from Facebook people, like from Zuckerberg and Sandberg personally, and lots of ex-Facebook employees. I'm just curious, overall, the company, you had a good relationship with the company, they knew what you were doing, and there was no sort of like, well, you can't talk about this, you can't talk to that person or anything like that?
No, I was allowed to ask anything. People could refuse to answer a question. A couple times they said, well, I don't want to get into that. But generally, they gave me their side of the story. There was no quid pro quo. I mean, I didn't show them the book in advance. And there were no restrictions about what I could write about. And if there was something I didn't find out, or, you know, just as a matter of course, everything that was told to me, I made sure was true, and I talked to people outside of Facebook, and as you mentioned, ex-employees, and sometimes I would talk to people and have one kind of conversation inside the company, another outside the company. So it was all good. You know, the access was just nothing but a plus. If you're writing a book about a company, you really want to know what the people at the company were thinking when they did this or when they did that, or, you know, to learn about something they did that wasn't public.
And generally the company itself feels like it is, they know that it's important to get the historical record out there in terms of their story as a company.
Yeah, that was one pitch that I gave them. I said, look, you folks are doing something really, really important. There's a real big impact on society. That's why I want to write the book in part, and that even if it isn't me, you owe it to the world to let someone tell the story.
You know, as someone who has written a book about tech history from this time period, I was really fascinated and like grateful for you finally laying out the real story of the early days of the company. Like, I feel like most people feel like they know the Facebook story because of the movie, but the reality of Facebook's early days is both more mundane and more amazing than what people saw in the movie.
Yeah. It's funny. I would go for more amazing. Sort of my base premise of journalism is that the reality of what you find, if your mind is open when you report, is always, and like not sometimes, always more interesting than any preconception you might have. And in this case, yeah, to be honest, I thought because there had been stuff written about Facebook's early days, I wouldn't spend that much time on it. But because of the trouble that Facebook ran into during the time I was researching the book over the last 3 years, I realized that this whole early Facebook and even the early life of Mark Zuckerberg had to be reexamined, and that we could see signs of what led Facebook to its problems early on. And so I spent, a considerable amount of time going over some of those things, coming up with some stuff that hadn't been reported before, or just looking at things with the benefit of hindsight that enabled me to set the foundation for the story of the company's growth and rise and the consequences that came of that.
Yeah, and you lay it out chronologically in a really compelling way. Like it's a really fast-paced read and like really dramatic. But well, like for example, like you lay this out, but you know, in your mind, when do you think, you know, just to get into some of the details of the history that you talk about, what do you feel was the thing that that made Zuckerberg realize he was onto something that was really big, as opposed to either just a lark or maybe a cool company that quit college for or whatever? What was the thing that you think, the event or the time period when Zuckerberg was like, oh, this is huge?
I think, you know, it wasn't one event. It was, you know, a cascade of events. So even though from the start, the Facebook, which is what it was called when, Zuckerberg released it to Harvard in February of 2004, you know, it captivated the campus, took it over. And then he found that it worked on other campuses, even when there was a competitor living on the other campus. So that was an interesting sign that he actually, tested this by the first places he expanded to were places where there was a competitor. He felt that, you know, let me go and topple someone over and see if this really works. Even so, when he got to Silicon Valley that summer of 2004, a few months after he started, and they were, double figures of campuses by then. He still had another project he was working on that he thought, well, maybe I'll work on this. And he would say to Sean Parker, you really think this is going to be big? But meanwhile, things kept falling in his lap. He, you know, with his connection to Parker, who, you know, he almost fortuitously ran into on the streets of Palo Alto, to renew an acquaintanceship from a meeting they had a little earlier, he was ushered into, office of Peter Thiel. Reid Hoffman had already taken an interest in him, but Hoffman didn't want to be a lead investor because he had LinkedIn going, and he didn't want to have that conflict of first and foremost. So then they get money, and then they're all of a sudden, they're this charmed company in Silicon Valley, moving too fast for him to go back to Harvard. So it probably wasn't really, I'd say, until the end of 2004, when they had a million users, that he really settled on, yeah, this is like a big thing. And then over the next couple of years, he started thinking much bigger and how he would take it from a college website to something that was going to be a worldwide force.
What in your mind do you think, in Zuckerberg's mind, is the fundamental thing that he's doing with Facebook, that Facebook itself is doing?
It's basically just connecting the world, getting everyone
right
on the same network and lighting up the social graph. And, you know, the social graph, in his, the way he talks about it, is this existing nexus of connections that people have.
And
if you map these connections, you know, they're not like lit until you're really connected online, or you might know someone. But he wants to light this whole, you know, complicated series, you know, of connections between this person, between that person, and then the people you know, and your relationship with the people your friends know. Just light that up and be able to map it through one place, which is Facebook.
Right. And what I was going to say, you sort of still get that sense from the quotes from him in the book that still excites him. Like, you know, you hear people say, like, why is he still doing this? Facebook is one. Why does he still care? But I guess in his mind, you know, there's like, what is it that they're still there for Facebook to do? It's that maybe in his mind, that overarching idea still isn't complete yet.
Yeah. I mean, he still wants to fulfill that. And I think it's important for him to be the person that's doing it. I talk about his childhood, and, you know, when he was at school in high school. He loved games like Civilization. He was a fanboy of Augustus Caesar. So he's very much, you know, likes the idea, besides the fact that I think he does believe it's a good thing for the world, but that he would be the person that conquers this, the world by connecting us.
So let's do get into some of the actual fun details that I hadn't heard before. I don't think I had a concept of this, but the like button was actually a very late addition for Facebook, much later than the news feed. And that's kind of curious to me because, I mean, reaction counts and things like that are so fundamental to how we understand the web and social media these days. And I mean, like, the dig button had already been around forever. I was just so surprised that that was late. And in fact, it took them for a while to adopt it.
Yeah. It wasn't that late. I mean, but it did come after the news feed, and it was a way originally proposed as a way to very quickly express your interest in, or your approval of something you saw without writing a comment. And it took over a year for it to be implemented because there was some skepticism on Zuckerberg's part that maybe this will make people less likely to post a comment. So if they could just say like and leave it at that, they wouldn't say anything. But actually, it was the opposite, because they used like as a measure of engagement and would show you posts that are liked more than posts that don't have likes attached to them. More people saw it, more people commented on it. But by then, they were thinking of the like button in a bigger way, that it would be something not only that would be useful to way to express something, but a way to provide a piece of data about you. And it turned out to be much more powerful than they even suspected when they started doing this. First of all, they spread it out throughout the web. It was the first thing really that took Facebook outside the borders of Facebook and extended its data gathering to millions and millions of websites, which put the like button on there. But the second thing is that it told them so much about who you were. And a researcher, not at Facebook, who was, I think, at Cambridge University at the time, later went to Stanford, who figures into the story in a couple ways. He figured out that, I think, with 15 likes, Facebook knew as much about you as a casual acquaintance. And with 30 likes, they knew about you, a friend. And with 300 likes, they knew as much about you as your spouse.
One of the things that I think a lot of people outside of tech are unaware of is the key role of Chamath Palihapitiya and his growth team. There was a time in early 2008 when growth had basically plateaued, and then it's his growth team that made Facebook into the 2 billion plus phenomenon that we now know today.
That's right. Yeah. And he sort of accumulated a team like the beginning of Mission Impossible, where you throw those pictures out there, or almost like the Dirty Dozen, where they take these misfits and make them into a team. He wanted his team to be thought of as misfits. Like, they were the people who do things that really push the edges of propriety in generating growth and doing things that you don't talk about outside of the growth group. And they lived in their own little grotto in the headquarters and got their way, because Zuckerberg supported them all the way. So when the growth team was interested in something, it got what it wanted. So they did all sorts of dicey tricks to goose growth. They did a lot of, in terms of, soliciting memberships, they would scrape all your contacts and other things, and can send out Facebook invitations to people. And the other part of what they did, they recognized early on that a big part of growing Facebook was retaining new users, because when you sign up for Facebook, before you build your network on it and get your friends, who people to friend you, you're vulnerable, because your newsfeed isn't that interesting. No one's posting things in your friend network. So they did things like they made up stories, maybe the first fake news, just so you'd have something on your newsfeed. And they'd also use something that Chamath referred to as dark profiles, which had come up earlier in the book. And Facebook has always said these don't exist, but Chamath told me that they did exist, and he would take out ads on Google and people's names who he thought might join Facebook that hadn't joined. And when, if they searched for their own name on Google, which everyone does, they would see an ad for themselves and saying, hey, you know, Joe Smith, you know, check out what we have on you at Facebook. And you click on it and you'd say, you know, you're just not on Facebook anyway. Why don't you just finish it up and sign up? And then they would bombard you with a feature called People You May Know, which we could talk about, to, you know, immediately get you to some friends, of, you know, and connect you with the people you knew already on Facebook, and then you were in.
When you go through airport security, there's one line where the TSA agent checks your ID and another line where a machine scans your bag. The same thing happens in enterprise security, but instead of passengers and luggage, it's end users and their devices. These days, most companies are pretty good at the first part of the equation, where they check user identity. But user devices can roll right through authentication without getting inspected at all. In fact, 47% of companies allow unmanaged, untrusted devices to access their data. That means an employee can log in from a laptop that has its firewall turned off and hasn't been updated in 6 months. Or worse, that laptop might belong to a bad actor using employee credentials. Collide finally solves the device trust problem. Collide ensures that no device can log into your Okta-protected apps unless it passes your security checks. Plus, you can use Collide on devices without MDM, like your Linux fleet, contractor devices, and every BYOD phone and laptop in your company. Visit collide.com/ride to watch a demo and see how it all works. That's KOLIDE.com/ride, collide.com/ride. I'm going to a big AI startup demo day here in the city tomorrow, and I will 100% be decked out in Mack Weldon clothing. Why? Well, Mack Weldon makes timeless apparel with modern performance fabrics for guys who want to look and feel sharp without sacrificing comfort. Mack Weldon clothes are designed to fit your style and the demands of modern life. They look like regular clothes, but feel like the latest in modern comfort. They're the go-to choice for guys who want to look great without even trying. Breathable underwear that keeps you cool, dry, and comfy all day. That's their AirKnit underwear. Crazy, comfortable, but elevated sweatpants, the Ace Collection. An upgraded classic polo with antimicrobial silver threads, the Silver Peak Polo. That's my personal fave. And ultra-soft antimicrobial tees for when you need to stay fresh longer. Their silver crewneck T-shirt. Get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code RIDE. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code RIDE.
Well, another thing that I forgot that your book reminded me of is that essentially, if from Facebook's perspective, it was always like a series of threats coming from these out. Like, it starts with Twitter, where Twitter gets very popular very fast, and it's fundamentally doing social media in a way that's fundamentally different than how Facebook was doing it. And then, you know, Instagram and Snapchat, on and on and on. It's like one of the things that they always seemingly understood was, you know, people had said as a knock on social media all the time that it was faddish, that something that worked would only work for a few years and then the next new hot thing. And so they were always really nimble about being aware of what the next new hot thing is and adapting with it.
Yeah, they were. And then, you know, sometime, you know, early in the 2010s, they became very methodical about that, about noticing what rose to the top. And they bought a company, an Israeli company called Anavo, which essentially was a company's business model was somewhat of a deception, that they would, you know, offer like tools for mobile that people would sign up for, but buried in the terms of service was the idea that you know, it would be sucking up their data. So by using that tool, Facebook was able to recognize early on what apps were getting a lot of traction. So they noticed that most famously about WhatsApp. That before people realized it, and people in the U.S. weren't aware of this because WhatsApp is so international, they thought, wow, here's a company that's like having tremendous growth, and this will be a threat to us. So Zuckerberg you know, instituted what I call the playbook, which was, you know, a series of, you know, prongs in his, you know, courtship of a company, you know, meant to break their will and have them sell the company to Facebook.
Well, and another example of that being the Instagram acquisition, which I had forgotten too, that Twitter actually had sort of the inside track on that, and it's just that Zuckerberg was not going to let Instagram get away.
Oh, he had a playbook and Twitter didn't. That's the bottom line. And the playbook is get personally involved, you know, bring them to your house, you know, can basically just bombard them and don't let them leave really until they're, you know, on board. And he would promise them independence. He'd say, hey, you could keep doing what you're doing, and we're just going to give you more and more resources to help you do it faster. And then he'd throw enough money at them that their investors would murder them if they turned it down.
It's not said explicitly, but kind of reading between the lines, there's a couple times in the book where the suggestion is that, like, Zuckerberg sort of resents on some level Instagram's success. Like, also reading between the lines, it seems like he kind of pushed out the Instagram founders and also the WhatsApp founders or whatever. Do you get that sense, too, that he's sort of not in any,
well,
like...
yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
I don't think you have to read too deeply between the lines to make those conclusions. Mm. I didn't maybe say it in those words, but you know what I do, and this is sort of my approach to how I do these things in general, is that I give you I tell them the story, and you're able to come to that conclusion just in the same way I would, but I don't have to circle it in red crayon. And I say explicitly in this case, the people in the Instagram team believed that Zuckerberg was, forcing them out, starving them of resources, and was jealous of the success of Instagram. And I point out a few times when, you know, he says almost defensively, like he's saying, yeah, they're, you know, successes, you know, because we gave them the resources. And when he told me that, something to that effect too, and I asked him directly because I've been hearing that this is, you know, the feeling among the Instagram team that he was jealous of Instagram's success, which is kind of weird because, yeah, he could take credit for it in a sense. He did give him the resources. He was smart enough to identify that this was a great company to buy. His $1 billion, amount that he gave to buy the company was an unbelievable deal. When I asked him about it, I said, "Well, are you jealous of Instagram?" You know, our relationship got to the point where I'd be asking him these direct questions, like left and right. He like paused for a long time and gave an answer, which, you know, so it was somewhat evasive, but didn't really clear up the question about whether he was jealous or not. It's clear that he was uncomfortable with trying to answer that question.
One other impression that I came away from, you know, as you said, the book is a lot of tracing the decisions that got Facebook to where it is, and also decisions that maybe got it into trouble. Sheryl Sandberg's hire, the way Sandberg and Zuckerberg divvied up duties, and essentially it was Sheryl would take over all of the parts of running Facebook as a business that Zuck didn't care about, and how, you know, you got to figure that inside the company, you can understand, well, I want to be working on the stuff that Zuck cares about, and this other stuff maybe isn't that important, and that might have led to a lot of their problems.
Right. I don't think the people who are working in Sheryl world, as I call it, felt that they weren't doing important work. But effectively, a lot of the problems that were bubbling up in that world, you know, just didn't get to Zuckerberg and the lieutenants around him to really set the priorities for the company. So that particularly came out, you know, when you trace back why all these, you know, things happened during the election, how Facebook was allowed, you know, made the decision to let fake news keep proliferating. I think that really could have benefited, you know, from more attention, you know, from Zuckerberg and his team. It did come before them at some point, but it was really, in the domain of Sheryl world. In terms of the Russian involvement, the chief security officer, Alex Stamos, reported up the chain to Cheryl. I mean, he has a C in his name, and he reported to the chief counsel, reported to the chief policy, you know, to the head policy person, who reported to Cheryl, and then, you know, forget getting up to Mark. You know that, you know, Stamos never had a one-on-one with Mark Zuckerberg.
Right, that's amazing. I didn't know that.
Which is crazy.
Yeah. Do you think that Sandberg? I get the sense that she would have left Facebook by now had all of the scandals and stuff not happened. Do you think that she doesn't have much time left at Facebook?
Well, I mean, that was my conclusion was, and I ran this theory by her, that, you know, and she told me that I thought I'd give Facebook 5 years. And I said, well, you know, my guess is, Cheryl, that, you know, you wanted to leave after the IPO, but the IPO was a disaster. And it took a few years for Facebook to recover from then. You want to leave on a high. And then after that, you know, tragically, her husband died. He was a fantastic guy. And that definitely threw her off her game, quite understandably, for months, really. And then, you know, and I told her, I was saying, you know, maybe you would have run for senator at that point, you know. But other people told me Kamala Harris had it in the bag. But and then, you know, Facebook's run into these other problems. Not so easy to leave in the middle of this crisis. And she told me, well, you know, first of all, you know, and she quite justifiably said, you know, my husband dying is a totally different kind of category of issue there. But that, you know, I don't want to run for office, she told me, and which is sort of counter to what everyone thinks about Cheryl. But she did say that if Clinton had won, she would have welcomed an opportunity to serve in that administration. Meanwhile, you know, I personally, you know, I don't say this in the book. The book is not for me to make judgments. It's for me to tell the story, and maybe people reading the book can come to that conclusion. Is I wouldn't be surprised if Cheryl, you know, found another opportunity for herself in the next year or so. I think that, you know, she's done a lot for Facebook, you know, and I do take her to task for a couple of things, you know, rising from the way the company was split and how, you know, she didn't elevate these things to Zuckerberg and, you know, and certainly, you know, didn't handle them well on their own. And it was, you know, I think the Facebook is going to be in trouble for the foreseeable future. So, you know, she's got a new domestic situation, you know, she's engaged, and I wouldn't be surprised. And this is just, you know, me talking, you know, as a guess. I wouldn't want to make it in the book, but, you know, she's an incredibly talented person. She might feel that she could do better by doing something else.
And as far as Zuckerberg, I heard you say, I think that the two words you've never heard at Facebook are succession plan.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I don't think, you know, he is going anywhere. If the board of directors, for some reason, wanted to say, you know, we had enough Zuck. He could always say, well, I have the voting stock, you know, try to get me out of here. But the people he puts on the board, you know, and he has a lot of say on it, you know, are generally supporters. Peter Thiel, I don't think, is going to say, you know, no more Zuck. They just appointed Drew Houston to the board. You know, Drew Houston didn't come on the board to throw out Mark Zuckerberg. I don't think that's a worry.
The final question I'm going to straight up steal from Casey Newton, because he noted that, you know, you've done book length dives into Apple and Google as well. How does Facebook's internal culture compare to other tech companies? Because I've always noted that over the years that, you know, every company has a different culture, but the people at Facebook are definitely, definitely different than other companies.
Yeah. And it's very much in Zuckerberg's image. You know, he is an ambitious person. He's a person who wants to get things out there in a hurry. You know, only recently have they, you know, made the statement saying, well, from here on in, we're going to actually try to figure out what the consequences are of things we do, you know, which one would hope that people do that from day one. But, you know, but now they say we're you know, they didn't exactly say we have no realization of that before, but we're going to think more about that. And it's also more of a, I wouldn't say like a literal cult of personality, but more of something where people wind up channeling their leader. And even though a company of Facebook size is over 30,000 people, most people will have never met Mark Zuckerberg. And, you'd be surprised if the chief security officer didn't sit down with him one by one. But, you can imagine the rank and file Facebook worker, doesn't spend time with Mark Zuckerberg. But many times I would hear people refer to something that this is what Mark thinks. Mark wants us to do X and Y. So it in that sense, it is something where he is, the person whose voice winds up in their head. And that's a little different, even though you say like Larry Page, was a strong, influence on the Google culture, you didn't hear that then. And even though Steve Jobs, obviously fantastic, unparalleled talent in Silicon Valley, it's like people weren't encouraged to think like Steve Jobs necessarily. Only Steve Jobs could think like Steve Jobs. So it is something like that. You go to the walls of headquarters are plastered with these posters that are basically things that, that either Zuckerberg said or, things that you'd think he'd say, move fast and break things. And what would you do if you're not afraid? So that message just gets pounded on you.
Well, as I mentioned in the intro, the book is Facebook, The Inside Story by Stephen Levy. Stephen, by the way, I read all of these books. This is the best tech book that I've read in several years. It was so fantastic and well written.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I encourage you to post a review on Amazon.
Will do. Thank you, Stephen.